Who are the ISIS insurgents in Iraq? Why are they making so much headway against the more numerous Iraqi security forces? What purpose do they serve for U.S. NATO imperial interests? Has Libya been liberated in the wake of the NATO intervention there in 2011? Can Western audiences overcome the spin and propaganda emerging both from NATO countries and from Russia in order to grasp the current situation in Ukraine? Is there any reason to hope these conflicts can be justly and peacefully resolved? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we spend most of the hour with geopolitical analyst Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. On today's program, Mahdi Nazemroya on Iraq, Libya, and the Ukrainian propaganda matrix. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 27th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. According to the New York Times, the mastermind behind the ISIS military success is former Ba'ath Party leader and Saddam Hussein's successor, General Ibrahim al-Duri. Duri is reportedly the head of the Iraqi rebel group Army of the Men of the Naqshbandi Order, as well as the supreme command for jihad and liberation based on his long-standing positions of leadership in the Naqshbandi sect in Iraq. In 2009, U.S. Iraqi Surge General David Petraeus, at the time heading the U.S. Central Command, claimed to reporters that Duri was in Syria. The curious fact is that despite being on the U.S. Most Wanted list since 2003, Duri has miraculously managed to avoid capture and now to return with a vengeance to retake huge parts of Sunni Iraq. Luck or well-placed friends in Washington? That's from the article, ISIS in Iraq, a CIA-NATO dirty war op, by William Engdahl, posted June 25th, originally appearing on RT. Today, Putin's presidential press secretary, Dmitry Peskov, reported that President Putin has asked the Russian legislature to repeal the authorization to use force that was granted in order to protect residents from former Russian territories that are currently part of Ukraine from the rabid Russophobic violence that characterizes Washington's stooge government in Kiev. Putin's hope for diplomacy over force rests on Germany and France. Both countries face Europe's budget and employment woes, and both countries have significant economic relations with Russia. If desire for national sovereignty still exists in the German or French governments, one or both could give the finger to Washington and publicly declare that they are unwilling for their country to be drawn into conflict with Russia for the sake of Washington's empire and the financial hegemony of American banks. Putin is betting on this outcome. If his bet is a bad one and Europe fails not only Russia but itself and the rest of the world by accommodating Washington's drive for world hegemony, Russia and China will have to submit to Washington's hegemony or be prepared for war. That's from the article, Can Putin's Diplomacy Prevail Over Washington's Coercion? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted June 25th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. In the wake of a Bundy Ranch crisis sparked by a militarized federal land grab effort in Nevada, It seems that the Department of Interior has set its sights on a new prize, this time targeting once-protected Indian reservation land on Pine Ridge in South Dakota. The Oglala Sioux and Lakota Sioux of the reservation have been told by the federal government that the National Park Service will be taking land that comprises the south unit of the Badlands National Park as a new tribal national park, only the wording in the bill clearly indicates that it will be a federally managed national park under the Department of Interior, giving mere lip service to its tribal title. The congressional bill has already been written, and if passed through Congress, both tribal members and non-tribal members will be stripped of their deeded land at a price set by the federal government. If owners do not accept Washington's offer, expected to be a meager one, the land can be acquired at no cost because the measure has waived all appraisal rights and stipulates that Washington can simply take Indian land by force under eminent domain. Already, many landowners are taking the position that they will not comply with the latest order from the government, leaving many to wonder whether this potential standoff will become the third wounded knee incident involving a standoff between the Sioux Nation and the U.S. federal government. That's from the article, Washington's Militarized Land Grabs, Targeting the Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota, by Patrick Henningsen. It's posted June 25th, originally published at 21st Century Wire. As Reuters reports, the chief executives of Russia's Gazprom and Austria's OMV sealed the deal to build a branch of the South Stream gas pipeline to Austria, a staunch defender of the project in the face of opposition from the European Commission. In other words, one short month after Putin concluded the Holy Grail deal with Beijing, he not only managed to formalize his conquest of Europe's energy needs with yet another pipeline, one which completely bypasses Ukraine for numerous reasons, but mostly one, call it a plan B, but scored a massive political victory by creating a fissure in the heart of the Eurozone after Austria openly defied its European peers and sided with Putin. Needless to say, the European Commission is furious and is digging in its heels, saying South Stream does not comply with EU competition law because it offers no access to third parties. But OMV CEO Gerhard Royce, in a stunning moment of realpolitik clarity and admission that when it comes to the energy future of Europe, Putin is more important than Mario Draghi, told a news conference after the signing. Europe needs Russian gas. Europe will need more Russian gas in future because European gas production is falling. I think the European Union understands this too. That's from the article, Putin scores another historic victory. Austria signs South Stream pipeline deal in defiance of Europe, by Tyler Durden. Posted June 25th, originally published at Zero Hedge. There are, of course, a lot of research that has documented the blunders, the laziness, the outright idiocy, and the hubris of the ruling class aristocrats, captains of industry, kings, diplomats, generals, and the ever-present uber-patriotic newspapers in every city looking to sell papers. Each of them had a role to play in the continued butchery that gutted an entire generation of young men who came home crazy, haunted, and demented, as well as mentally, spiritually, and or physically disabled, because of the miscalculations of each nation's incompetent and misguided leaders who couldn't get themselves to use the words retreat, or we were wrong, or mea culpa, or please forgive me. Of course, the lessons from each and every international or civil war has been consistently unheeded by subsequent generations of our so-called national leaders in the military, industry, or politics. This 2014 centennial year of the beginning of the war to end all wars will offer many opportunities to explore the blunders of the national leaders that allowed the mutual slaughter to continue, including the Christmas Truce of 1914, where the generals on all sides chose to squelch the efforts of disillusioned soldiers on all sides of no man's land to end the war then and there. Heeding the wisdom of the millions of soldiers in the trenches would have saved the bodies, minds, and souls of tens of millions of combatants. That's from the article, The Lessons of World War I, the 100th Anniversary of the Assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, by Dr. Gary G. Coles, posted June 25th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu. Mahdi Darius Nazamroya is a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization. He's also a contributor at the Strategic Culture Foundation, Moscow, and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. An award-winning author and geopolitical analyst, Nazamroya is the author of The Globalization of NATO and a forthcoming book, The War on Libya and the Recolonization of Africa. He has also contributed to several other books ranging from cultural critique to international relations. He has served as an election observer recently both in El Salvador and, as detailed last week, in Syria. He was also present in Libya during the NATO military intervention there in 2011. He's contributed dozens of articles to globalresearch.ca. He was in Winnipeg, Manitoba recently, where I had a chance to interview him about some of the major developments on the world scene. The following discussion took place at CKUW's studio at the University of Winnipeg on June 18th, 2014. Here is my conversation with Mahdi Nazamroya.
I know we're hearing now reports that the Americans, the U.S. federal government, says it's speaking to the Iranian government about cooperation to help al-Maliki's government in Baghdad. But that is incorrect. It's not true. The reports are very misleading. In fact, many in Iraq, as well as that region, think that the United States is behind the instability in Iraq. This talk about helping Iraq is actually very misleading because the United States has directed these people. This army did not just just appear in the desert out of thin air. This army of terrorists and murderers and thugs, this army has been built and trained and funded by the United States, very frankly. It's not been a year that it took place. It's not been 2 years. It's been since 2003 this has been in the works. You can see the Washington Post even admits these groups had their funding originally coming from the United States, from the Pentagon in Iraq. The people that are fighting in Syria and Iraq, they were funded by the U.S. government. And
we've had this conversation before with regard to the rise of these Islamic, or you call them extremist Islamic factions and brigades. And I think I interpreted that as basically the tried and true, long-standing divide and conquer type strategy.
Exactly. My point here is that what's happening in Iraq today, it's a manifestation of U.S. policy. There's very misleading statements that what's happening in Iraq is the manifestation of the failure of U.S. policy, but that's not true. This is actually the manifestation of U.S. objectives to divide that region, to create instability there. And in fact, the Iranians, the head of the Iranian armed forces, made a statement saying the United States is lying, we are not cooperating with them, and they and the Israelis are behind this deviant phenomenon in Iraq. These foreign fighters in Iraq, they are the tools of the United States, and we know that very well. So when the United States talks about, oh, we're going to work with the Iranians and cooperate with them on a security and military level to help Iraq, it just it's nonsense. And it's falsehoods, and that is an official position. I'm quoting or paraphrasing from someone in the Iranian military.
There was interesting. There was back in about the middle of the last decade, there was a lot of talk about something called the surge, which was being framed by the Americans as the reason why there had been some moderate successes there. But you know, my understanding behind the scenes is that there was connections with sort of an agreement with Iranian forces, like if the Americans had gone too far, that the Iranians, they would just use their forces to just, you know, take over and you know, occupy a lot of the areas that had been under U.S. control. Do you know anything about that?
Well, we should
U.S.-Iranian types of.
Well, we should start this discussion by starting with the premise that a lot of the groups that the United States supported in Iraq when it invaded with Britain were also Iranian allies. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Maliki belongs to the Doha Party, and that's a group that's supported by Iraq. By Iran. He was in Syria, also Iran's ally. Strategic ally. Then there's other parties like the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. It's changed its name to distance itself from that decidedly Iranian orientation to the it's changed its name, that party. I can't recall right now. That's Hakim's party. These parties were allied to Iran, as well as these are Shiite parties, many of them, are predominantly Shiite parties. Then there's also the Kurdish groups, which also have good relations with the Iranians. The Kurds in northern Iraq were allied to the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq War. They sided with Iran, and they have very close ethnic, linguistic ties. They are essentially our Iranians. So these groups that the United States has supported are tied to Iran, and this brought common grounds to them. There are also Shiite groups like the Sadrists,
yes,
which are named after
Sadr.
Yes, exactly, and he has the Mahdi army. Or an Arabic Mahdi army. This group is actually anti-American, and they've had good relations with the Iranians, but they're anti-American. But my point is that the United States needed to talk to the Iranians for many things when it invaded Iraq, and ironically, it blamed Iran for a lot of the problems in Iraq, but that went against the face of the fact that all its allies in Iraq were the same one as the Iranian, the same people as that the Iranians supported. So it didn't add up. I want to mention what I was told by a diplomat in North Africa. I was told when I said that the insurgents in Libya are going to be enemies of countries like Russia, Iran, Syria, China. I said that these aren't revolutionaries. And I was told by the diplomats, we saw the same thing in Iraq. You saw a lot of Iraqi groups siding with the U.S., collaborating with them. But once Baghdad fell and Saddam Hussein was ousted, President Hussein was ousted, some of them changed their orbit, and a lot of them, their interests changed. So there are converging interests with the United States. And in Iraq, that's what happened. The Iranians and these Iraqi groups had converging interests, but as long as the interests were shared. I don't think that the Iranians cooperate with the Americans in Iraq as much as the Americans want to make it look like. I think they're doing that to create divisions. I think the goal of the United States is to create Shiite Muslim and Sunni Muslim, as well as Muslim versus Christian differences in the Middle East. So their main goal is to make the Shiite Muslims and the Sunni Muslims fight each other in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, and the rest of the region. And their secondary goal is to divide, make the Muslims fight the Christians and other groups. And that's what they've been doing. If you look at the death squads in Iraq, they were under U.S. control. The Ministry of Interior was headed by a general who took direct orders from the United States. That's where the death squads were. I mean, it's not this shit. In fact, one thing that the media also lies about is they call the government in Iraq a Shiite government. It's not a Shiite government at all. It's actually, if you look at the government, the cabinet, it's proportionally divided. Not deliberately, in a lot of cases. Some of it is deliberate, like when you talk about the prime minister and the status of the presidents and the vice presidents. Not the prime minister. Only when you talk about the president and the vice presidents, there is a deliberate division amongst the Arabs and the Kurds.
Sort of a power-sharing kind of arrangement?
It's almost. The president is a Kurd and a Sunni Muslim, but there's two vice presidents who represent the other two large demographic groups. So the Shiite Arabs and the Sunni Arabs each have a prime minister. Vice president. And this is deliberate. Now, in regards to the cabinet, the government of Iraq, that's not the case. It's everything there. The government does represent the demographic division of the country, but that's organically. It wasn't deliberately. We're going to give this many cabinet portfolios to a Sunni Arab or to a Kurd. It just happens so much. It actually is a reflection of just like our Senate or governments reflect our divisions in Canada provincially, I'd say. Maybe it might not be exact, but so you do have Kurds, and you have Shiite Arabs and you have Sunni Arabs in the government. So, for example, the foreign minister is a Sunni Kurd. You have several ministers in the housing or energy. They are not Shiites. The prime minister is a Shiite. So this is not a Shiite government. So whenever they typecast this government as a Shiite government, it's to play along into this narrative of Shiites versus Sunnis. Uh-huh. In fact, the ISIS or the ISIS or ISIL, I think it's more proper to call it the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant than it is to call it the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. That group is not a Sunni group. In fact, to label that group as a Sunni group is to basically play into this narrative of it's Sunnis versus Shiites. They're not following any Sunni Muslim tenets. They are not Sunni Muslims. They are not considered Muslim by the people of that region. And the portrayal of them as Sunni Muslims is just part of this narrative of Shiites versus Muslims, just like how the narrative of Nouri al-Maliki's government in Baghdad as a Shiite government is part of this narrative of Shiites versus Sunnis.
This is the Global Research News Hour. Our guest has been Mahdi Darius Nazemroya, who is a sociologist, a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization. And he's joining me in person at the studio at CKUW Radio in Winnipeg. Mahdi, you mentioned Libya earlier, and I know that you had spent considerable time there at the time when it was the target of NATO bombs. And in fact, you have a forthcoming book on that overthrow of Gaddafi and that whole episode. What is your take on what has happened since the Gaddafi government was defeated? What are the circumstances we're seeing in Libya now as opposed to previously?
Well, I think back to Libya a lot. They've destroyed the country. This was a very affluent country. It was a model in Africa and the Arab world. It had flaws just like any other country, but in many respects it was a leader. It had very high savings. It had a high savings. It was not indebted. There was relatively good health care, public health care. Education was relatively good. They funded students to learn outside of the country. It was not a poor country. And it was a country that was increasingly buying into Western corporations or investing in them. Its sovereign investment funds were relatively very large. This was a country that actually proposed to buy British Petroleum. It proposed to buy several Italian firms. Now, that was before 2011. after 2011, the country is heavily indebted, infrastructure is destroyed, poverty is up, crime is up, high death toll, people are being killed, armed gangs are up, sectarianism exists. And what do I mean by sectarianism? Well, I mean by tribal differences. So tribalism has exploded in the most negative way. There's clan fighting. Any type of problem that we've seen previously in other places that the United States and its allies have had adventures in or intervened in now exists in Libya. They've basically, the east of the country, where Benghazi is located, Cyrenaica, as we would say in English, this area, Balkh, it's virtually a separate state. You know, the central government has very little control. Libya's new foreign imposed government, or the foreign imposed system, has very little control outside of its offices in Tripoli. The only places there is some control are the ports, and that's not even absolute. So this is what they've done to Libya. It's a destabilized state. It is meeting some, not all the time, it's meeting some of its foreign contracts or foreign obligations of sending energy out. And I think the United States wants that. I think the goal of the United States is to have countries like Libya to be able to meet their foreign obligations by sending gas or oil out of the country, but to not have a stability in their own homes, to always be at one another's throats, internal chaos, but to be able to meet their foreign obligations. And I think in Iraq, the situation is similar. They want Iraq to be able to export oil or gas and to meet its international contracts, but always to be unstable inside and fighting internally, societally, be divided. And this gives the United States and its allies huge leverage in these countries. So if one government, the government doesn't listen to them, or one political faction, they can easily switch sides and support another faction against them and then get what they want. I mean, this is kind of the scenario that's being played out in Mexico. Most of us look at Mexico or North American in North America, we look at Mexico as a stable country. But in fact, if you go to the countryside and stuff, there's fighting. Thousands of people die a year because of the drug wars. The United States pushes there, and there is internal instability in Mexico, but it still meets all its foreign obligations and contracts, contract obligations. So I think this is the model that the United States wants in places like Libya and Iraq. I mean, I've hesitated using the word failed state about Libya, but I mean, I think that I can throw that word out, that they've essentially created a failed state in Libya, just like they have in Somalia or Afghanistan.
Mm. So essentially U.S. There's U.S. Resource interests or resource interests that U.S. corporations are seeking to capitalize, as well as U.S. military detachments that benefit from these overthrows, but not so much the people.
No, the people do not benefit whatsoever. None of this is about people.
It's not about responsibility to protect.
It's never about helping people.
Because that's basically the way it's sold to the
It's always
public.
Sold like that. I mean, before this, they used to sell democracy, democratization. Before that, they would sell fighting authoritarianism. Before that, expanding Christianity and civilization, white man's burden. They've always used some type of pretext for what they've doing. But underneath all these pretexts was simply greed and self-interest. I mean, where's the responsibility to protect in Palestine or in Saudi Arabia? I mean, this is all nonsense. It has nothing to do with humanitarianism, and it has nothing to do with democracy. I was in Libya. I remember when African refugees were trying to leave the country, NATO boats watched them die in the ocean. They didn't get any humanitarian assistance. They were left to die in the ocean. That's there. It's part of the public record. Anybody can cross-check what I'm saying and verify. They let ships filled with African refugees, migrant workers leaving Libya, die in the ocean in the Mediterranean Sea, without helping them. So they watched. I mean, it was never about helping anybody in Libya or in the African continent. It was about self-interest.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg, campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM, and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website, globalresearch.ca. I'd like to take a few moments to acknowledge stations across North America that broadcast the Global Research News Hour. The show can be heard on radio station CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, BC, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Boston College Radio WZBC 90.3 FM broadcasts the Global Research News Hour occasionally during the Truth and Justice Radio programming slot Sundays at 7 a.m. Eastern Time. Tune in every Saturday at 6 a.m. to Burnaby radio station CJSF out of Simon Fraser University, which broadcasts the program at 90.1 FM to most of Greater Vancouver from Langley to Point Grey and from the North Shore to the U.S. border, and also on 93.9 FM cable in the communities of SFU, Burnaby, New Westminster, Coquitlam, Port Moody, Surrey, and Delta in British Columbia, Canada. And CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario, broadcasts the Global Research News Hour every Wednesday at midnight. Many thanks to these and other community radio stations for making the Global Research News Hour available to listeners far and wide. On today's program, we're focusing on an extensive conversation with Mahdi Nazem Roya, sociologist and research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization. We reviewed recent developments on the world stage. Before the break, we spoke about Iraq. For the duration of the hour, we'll be concentrating on the situation in Ukraine. Mahdi has written several articles on the Maidan, the Kiev push, and media portrayals demonizing Vladimir Putin. In late May, he produced a 1.5-hour video documentary called Welcome to Newlandistan, Propaganda and the Crisis in Ukraine. Before resuming our conversation with Mahdi Nazem Roya, I wanted to review some of the key events that led to the current crisis, which has catalyzed a confrontation between NATO and Russia. On November 21, 2013, the Ukrainian government backed away from the signing of an association agreement and deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the European Union. This move sparked the beginning of the Euromaidan protests, with 2,000 protesters gathering at Kiev's Maidan Nezalezhosti. January 16, 2014, MPs from the President Yanukovych's Party of Regions moved forward legislation that would severely restrict anti-government protests. According to the new rules, the unauthorized installation of tents, stages, or amplifiers in public places in Ukraine will be punished by a fine of up to $640 or by up to 15 days in detention, and people and organizations who provide facilities or equipment for unauthorized meetings will be liable to a fine of up to $1,275 or by detention of up to 10 days. February 16th, anti-government protesters ended a three-month-long occupation of the building housing Kiev City Hall, along with other municipal buildings in the city, and ceded it to OSCE monitors. At the same time, authorities withdrew riot police from their barricades near the Dynamo Kiev football stadium. This was in an effort to de-escalate the conflict, which resulted in the deaths of six protesters and the arrest of 234. February 18th, clashes erupt between Maidan protesters and police, killing 18, including 7 police officers. Hundreds are wounded. 25,000 protesters are encircled in Independence Square. Over the course of the next 48 hours, 88 people would be killed, many the victims of snipers. On February 21st, Yanukovych and the opposition parties would sign a settlement agreement mediated by Poland, Russia, Germany, and France. The terms of this agreement would ensure the return of the presidential elections by the end of the year, the creation of a national unity government by early March, and the return of the 2004 constitution, along with the cessation of the violence which had gripped Kiev over the precious few days, and the release from prison of former Prime Minister and Yanukovych rival Yulia Tymoshenko. A portion of the Maidan demonstrators refused to accept the agreement, brokered by Yanukovych and the opposition, declaring that nothing short of the president's resignation would be accepted by them. A leader of the ultranationalist right sector group stated that, quote, "The agreements that were reached do not correspond to our aspirations. Right sector will not lay down arms," unquote. That evening, Yanukovych fled the city. February 23rd, a rump parliament of 328 MPs of the Rada voted unanimously for the impeachment of Mr. Yanukovych. This is short of the 75% mandated under the Ukrainian constitution. Oleksandr Turchynov is appointed interim president and would serve until May 25th when the presidential election is to be called. February 26th. A soon-to-be-leaked phone call between the Estonian Foreign Minister Urmas Paet and EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton, judged legitimate by the Estonian government, confirmed that snipers had shot at both police and protesters, dismantling the narrative that the sniper shootings were ordered by Yanukovych. February 28th, Russian troops took control of the strategic facilities in Crimea, including the airport in Simferopol and a military port in Sevastopol. March 6th, U.S. President Obama denounces the Crimean Parliament's referendum on separating from Ukraine and joining the Russian Federation and announces an executive order authorizing sanctions. Interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk declares the vote illegitimate. March 9th, Vladimir Putin defended the Crimean referendum and the decision by Russia to send a Russian force presence there. Meanwhile, thousands of activists supportive of greater autonomy and possible referendum on secession rallied in Donetsk. A pro-Kiev rally in Sevastopol, Crimea, was attacked by pro-Russian supporters. March 11th, the Crimean parliament declared independence from Ukraine and announced it would ask to return to the Russian Federation. March 13th, clashes between pro-Kiev demonstrators and pro-Moscow protesters in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk left one dead and at least another dozen injured. March 17th, final results released today from the referendum in Crimea indicated that 96.8% of voters supported reunification with Russia. March 20th, President Obama announced an additional round of sanctions on senior Russian officials as well as on individuals and entities that provide material support to the Russian government. He also announced the issuance of an executive order that allows for sanctions against major sectors of the Russian economy, including financial services, energy, metals and mining, engineering and defense and related material. The EU slapped sanctions of their own on Russia. Russia responded with visa bans on 9 U.S. officials. March 21st, Ukraine and the EU signed the core provisions of an association agreement committing Ukraine to greater economic and political cooperation with the EU, the same deal rejected by Yanukovych in November. Meanwhile, President Putin signed the legislation formally completing the process of admitting Crimea and Sevastopol into Russia. March 23rd, anti-Western rallies are staged in the eastern Ukrainian cities of Donetsk, Kharkov, Lugansk, and Odessa. April 1st, NATO announced that it will suspend all practical civilian and military cooperation with Russia. Meanwhile, Gazprom eliminated a discount on natural gas imports given to Ukraine in November, raising the price by $117 to $385.50 per 1,000 cubic meters. April 8th, Ukrainian Interior Minister Arsen Ayakov describes what his government calls an anti-terrorism operation directed at pro-Russian protesters in the eastern city of Kharkiv. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry declared Russia's actions to be, quote, an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary. April 29th, pro-Russian separatists opened fire on a police station in Luhansk while separatists prepared for a referendum in Slovyansk. May 2nd, between 30 and 45 pro-Russian activists died when the trade union building in Odessa caught fire following clashes with pro-Kiev activists. Subsequent footage revealed pro-Kiev demonstrators were hurling Molotov cocktails at the pro-Russian side. There appeared to be pro-Russian provocateurs collaborating with police and a noticeable lag in the time it took for firefighters to appear on the scene. May 7th, Russian President Putin called on pro-Russian rebels in the Donetsk region to postpone an upcoming referendum vote on the region's status. May 12th, following a referendum in the Donetsk region, lauded as a success by pro-Russian separatist groups, the leadership of the People's Republic of Donetsk has asked to be absorbed into Russia. Throughout these and other events, there has been an information war in which news from Western media and from Russian media are being presented as skewed in the direction of propaganda. I spoke to Mahdi Nazemroya to find out what he thought of these charges. Ukraine, which is that other great flashpoint we're seeing on the global stage right now, and it's being framed as a power struggle, basically where Russia is being portrayed as going out and annexing territory for based on some outdated concerns about Cold War never having quite gotten over the Cold War. In terms of what we're seeing with Ukraine and some of the developments that are happening in the eastern part of the country, what is your sense of the way things are playing out right now?
Well, I think what's happening in eastern Ukraine are crimes against humanity and war crimes. And
perpetrated by the Russians?
No, not perpetrated by the Russian people or the Russian Federation. Perpetrated by a junta. Well, it's not, I guess technically it's not a junta anymore with the election of Poroshenko. But perpetrated by American proxies in that country. The United States has been involved with every minute detail of the fighting in eastern Ukraine. It's sent aid to the military and to the junta government, and it's been totally involved in the process as a means of combating, instigating, isolating, hurting, and destabilizing the Russian Federation and its allies in the Commonwealth of Independent States. I want to be very categorical and frank about this. At its basis, the Russian people have not forgotten the Cold War, but they're not the ones that are continuing the Cold War. They're being forced into a Cold War posture by the United States and its allies, who never thought the Cold War ended. I mean, all this talk about the Cold War ending in 1991 is something, it's fantasy for the public. The United States' mentality is to conquer. So the Cold War was an ended of a phase, but it never ended. The United States just turned its attention not only to Russia and to China, but to the Middle East and other parts of the world. Its attention was always there, but basically for what it calls, what has been called by academics as a unipolar world, or the New World Order, as some would call it. That's been its aim, unipolar hegemony over the rest of the globe.
Could you maybe just confirm that with like evidence and facts? Because I've gotten into some angry online exchanges, and the people who insist that the Maidan, that was totally the Ukrainian people, that NATO and the United States had nothing to do with it. They just were like Johnny come latelys. Where is the evidence that this was very much orchestrated by the U.S. and Western forces?
I can give you multiple direct forms of evidence, as well as circumstantial evidence. And together they make a very convincing package of what's happening. Before I mention this, I'd like to say that I'm in touch with people in Ukraine, people who were against Yanukovych and people who supported Yanukovych. So I've spoke to people directly in Ukraine. People in Ukraine, many of them are aware of the fact that he ordered the security and police forces not to use weapons. So that is widely known in Ukraine. Maybe some diehard fanatics aren't aware of that or refuse to acknowledge it. But the president of Ukraine, of the Ukrainian Republic, the former president, or if you still consider him the current president, Viktor Yanukovych, ordered them not to use heavy arms. Let's start with the fact that Victoria Nuland, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, a tape was released by unknown sources. I personally think it was Russian intelligence, released a tape showing of her conversation with the American ambassador to Kiev, where they were selecting who would become the prime minister of that country. You know, they were selecting and saying that we want Yatsenyuk to become the prime minister, and he did. They were actually organizing the structure in the cabinet. We know now, and in fact, Ms. Noland herself admitted this to the U.S. Congress during a hearing of the Foreign Affairs Committee for the House of Representatives. She admitted that the snipers that killed people in Euromaidan were not from the government. They were a third party. We know now they were a third party. And, well, I knew that before she admitted it, but they've been forced to admit that because of another leaked tape, and this was probably from Ukrainian intelligence. This leaked tape showed Catherine Ashton talking to the Estonian foreign minister. And let me point something out while I'm speaking about the Estonian foreign minister. He comes from an anti-Russian country that's a member of NATO and the European Union. So this is no friend of Vladimir Putin or the Kremlin or of Russia. This is a foreign minister for a NATO country admitted and even said in this leaked tape to Catherine Ashton, who is the European Union's High Commissioner for Foreign and Security Affairs. He told her, "Miss Ashton, I was there and these Euromaidan people were beating politicians and intimidating them. And I was told by many of the protesters in the Ukrainian civil society who were against Yanukovych that they believe that these people, Yatsenyuk, were involved with the snipers. They believe that the snipers was actually brought in by the people who took power. And they even complained that they're refusing to investigate now." So this leak was made public, and if it wasn't for the Russian media and alternative media, CNN, BBC, CBC would have all ignored it. And it's because of this that Victoria Nuland was forced to admit that it was third party snipers were involved, and she kind of tried to brush it off by saying the government's going to investigate. They haven't investigated. If we look at what the same characters have done in Odessa, on the Black Sea coast, one of Ukraine's most famous cities. Well, they also use the same tactics. They brought in snipers, they killed the unionists, and they killed the, they're called pro-federalization activists. These are Ukrainians who want the country to be federalized. So they attacked them. You can see that they were in cahoots or cooperating with the security forces of the new regime, and they killed these people, and there was a total blatant cover-up of the murder there. And in fact, members of this new government or their support, political supporters, were glad that these innocent people were murdered. You know, one of them actually said, "Let the demons burn in hell." And very disgusting stuff that's not acceptable in any free and tolerable society where there's tolerance. And I don't think that anybody in Canada would find it acceptable, and I think we should oppose it in places like Ukraine. But in regards to other evidence about what's happening in that country and how it was a coup, there was not only the snipers, not only the fact that the U.S. government picked the government, like the prime minister and the cabinet. On February 21st, the European Union, through the Federal Republic of Germany, the French Republic, and Poland. These three countries had their top diplomats go to Kiev and negotiate negotiate an agreement between the people of the opposition, the politicians in the opposition, and the government. They made a negotiation for to create a unity government and to end the crisis. What happened is the next day, the snipers killed people. And the government was attacked. In fact, I think it's very important to point out that it was right after the snipers killed people that the government was ousted. I think this was coordinated. It circumstantially looks very coordinated. And the other point is that the European Union, through Poland, France, and Germany, never tried to enforce or get their friends in Ukraine to actually meet their obligations. The government side fulfilled its obligations, but the people who pretended to represent Euromaidan didn't. And while I'm bringing this up, I think it's very paramount that I point out that yes, there were people involved in Euromaidan that were very bad and did this out of self-interest, like Timoshenko later on. She come Yulia Timoshenko later on when she's freed, she gets involved with it. But or Yatsenyuk, but there was also good people. So there are good people in the grassroots, and they were used. They were used and misled as tools, and a lot of them admit that now. So don't think that we're I'm just selling off Euromaidan, but it was manipulated. Mm-hmm. I want to point this out: is it was manipulated. The European Union set up this agreement, didn't fulfill it, and in fact, as soon as they took over the country, these politicians from the opposition side, who I like to call neo-orangists, because they're a continuation of the Orange Revolution. Well, these guys took over the parliament and they started passing laws. In fact, they gave the position, they put a new acting president into place, but it was totally unconstitutional. Everything they did was unconstitutional. Regardless of whether you support Euromaidan or not, the facts are is they broke, their actions were illegal. And
there is a constitutional process for impeaching a president.
Exactly, and they didn't follow it. They did not follow any constitutional processes, and at the end, they try to create some sort of rump constitutional process through a rump Rada or parliament, which was, by that mm-hmm. time, it was totally illegal and late.
Okay, so what are your thoughts about the way the media... I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of... concerned about the way Western media have been portraying this whole situation. What about the Russian media? Are you seeing indications of propaganda on the other side?
Well, I think it's important for us to know, always look at the source of control of a media organization. I mean, what I mean by that is the power behind any media network or outlet. You have to look at who finances it or who owns it. That's also paramount when we analyze what the message coming from these sources is. The Russians, of course, are representing their interests. But I think that even if you are critical of what they do, it's important to note that they're much closer to the truth than the corporate media in North America or the European Union is. I mean, they've done a much better job of describing what's happening in Ukraine, regardless of your position on Vladimir Putin or the Kremlin. The Russian media has done a much better job of telling us something that's closer to the truth than American or Canadian or British or French or German media sources. So I do. Yes, I agree that there is an agenda behind any news network or media outlet, but that's where agency of the individual comes into play. You have to make your own decisions, and I think diversification of your sources of information are very important. So you can look at what CBC, Radio Canada, or the BBC, or the Winnipeg Free Press says, but then you can also look what Russia Today, RIA Novosti, or Press TV in Iran have to say.
Voice of Russia.
Yeah, Voice of Russia, CCTV in China, Telesur in Venezuela. In fact, I think it's very important that these networks from countries like Russia, Iran, Venezuela, China have arisen, because they've given us diversity and they've broken the monopoly that CNN International and BBC World enjoy, a monopoly on information and messages. So now we have choices and we can be smarter about, we can shop around and we can hear multiple messages and decide which one's closer to the truth. I think that's one of the only reasons we know about the neo-Nazis in Ukraine or about the murderers in Syria and Iraq. I think if everybody thinks back to 2011 and 2012 and 13 and the previous 3 years, the US, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, they were denying that Al-Qaeda was in Libya or in Iraq. They were denying it outright. And it's because of the Russian media and the Iranian media and the job they've done in disseminating the information about these guys, about Al-Qaeda in Libya and Syria, that the US and Britain have been forced, and Canada have been forced to acknowledge the existence of these groups. So I think it's very important we recognize that fact. It's the same thing with the fascists in Ukraine. There are fascists in Ukraine. Whether you support them or not, the fact is there are people that are giving wearing swastikas, that are giving Nazi salutes, and who believe Jews and ethnic Russians should be cleansed from Ukraine. These people exist. They've made the statements. The proof is in the pudding. We have one Ukrainian governor who was saying Hitler was a hero. He came to liberate Ukraine. The man doesn't know anything about his history, but his perception was that Ukraine came to liberate Ukraine from the Soviet Union. He made this speech public, and the CBC didn't say anything about it. It was the Russian
media.
It's a
suspicious omission.
It was a very telling suspicion. Omission. And it was the Russian media and the Iranian media and the Chinese media that mentioned it, not the Canadian media, not the American or British media.
So you are going to be headed to Ukraine soon?
Hopefully I will be going into Ukraine. I mean, I don't have an exact date. Hopefully I'll be in the country to see things for myself, yes.
Okay. Well, Mahdi Nazemroya, I think that many of our listeners are very impressed with your work with the Center for Research on Globalization. I hope you'll keep us enlightened on your intelligent observations, and we'll maintain your analysis on the website. And well, thank you very much for sharing your time with us and your thoughts.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad to be here in person at the University of Winnipeg and at the radio station.
Okay, thanks a lot. Mahdi Nazemroya, sociologist, research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization, and he has contributed extensively on the Global Research website. Our show. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our program every week on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across the country. The show can be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and can be downloaded from the website globalresearch.ca. Thank you for joining us. If you have any questions or comments about today's program, feel free to send your feedback to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Join us again next week.